Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Dear friends, we are so sorry about the ads. They are a nightmare in every way, but with your donations, we can get rid of ads someday.
Beautiful, Kevin.
Thanks, Rob.
Bach and Harnick are smiling so
your
big
hearts
right
out.
Now. Friends, yes, we are back with a new plea. Much like those adorable puppets from Avenue Q, we are asking for you to give us your money.
For those of you who have headed over to Patreon to throw a little money our way, we thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts.
Your contributions are the only budget we have for this show, and it provided us a new soundboard and better studio space, so a thank you.
Thank you. And as you know, nothing is more fulfilling than talking to the legends of Broadway and hearing them share their thoughts, wisdom, and talents with all of us. However, it does cost money.
And if you want to help us keep the show going, please head over to patreon.com. That's patreon.com. Search for Behind the Curtain, and you can give as little as a dollar a month. And trust me, that dollar will help us more than you will ever know.
Plus, for certain monetary donations, you will get to pick your favorite thing and have advanced knowledge of our future guests so you can ask the legends your own questions.
Ooh. Or you can simply leave canned goods and an original cast recording of How Now, Dow Jones outside our doors if you don't want to contribute on patreon.com.
Truth. So once again, please head over to patreon.com. That's patreon.com to help us out. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
In 1955, today's guest arrived in New York City with a dream to be on Broadway. Well, 60-plus years later, not only has his dream come true, his story and his work ethic have inspired countless artists to follow in his footsteps.
Oh, and what footsteps they are. Today's guest was in the original Broadway productions of, get ready, New Girl in Town, West Side Story on stage and on film, Redhead, Gypsy, Hello Dolly, Anyone Can Whistle, George M., the iconic 1969 Our Town, Follies, Barnum, Sunset Boulevard, The Scarlet Pimpernel, yes, and Trevor Nunn's Oklahoma, not to mention the countless regional theaters, summer stocks, and dinner theaters he has graced.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Gwen Verdon, Bob Fosse, Hal Prince, Lee Remick, Jerome Robbins, Ethel Merman, Henry Fonda, and how he was the cover boy for After Dark magazine. Here is the eternally youthful.
Did your research. Oh my God.
It is the wonderful and youthful Harvey Evans.
Hi, Harvey. See, I only read my part of the introduction, so I didn't even get to that part about he was on the cover of After Dark
How'd
magazine.
You find that out?
Well, so when we Google you, because that's our main form of research now, is Google.
There's
the internet. There's this thing called Google Images. And so it shows photos of the person. And most of the photos, Harvey, are you on the cover of After Dark magazine with only a straw hat and a smile.
Oh, we are finding that, and we are going to
share
the glory that is you on that cover.
It gets passed around a lot, and I hear amongst After Dark collectors, it's one of the most coveted magazines. I'm not joking. So, Harvey, how did that happen? How did you get on the cover of After Dark magazine?
It was because I got Our Town and Follies at the same time, more or less.
Oh, wow.
And, excuse me, Craig Zaden, who was worked for After Dark magazine, called me and said, we want to do an article on you. Would you mind? And I said, no. And they said, would you send over some pictures? So I sent over my pictures, and they were rejected.
Oh.
And I said, why? And they said, they're not up to date enough, and we want to send you to Ken Duncan to have your picture taken. Well, now, Ken was one of those he preferred nudes, most of them did. And I said, no, I can't go to Ken Duncan. I'm a boy from Cincinnati, Ohio. I can't. And they said, well, we're going to pay for it. And please. And I got to tell you that 5 minutes working with Ken Duncan, I had my clothes off. Now, not totally clothes off, but He took some beautiful, beautiful pictures of me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the photos are gorgeous, and it's such a cool spread. So congratulations on that. Now, you said you were a boy in Cincinnati.
Yes.
So how did you discover the joys of theater living in Cincinnati?
I don't know. My mom and dad sent me to dancing school when I was young, when maybe 4 or 5 years old.
Oh, wow.
And they said I was shy. That's all they told me. And they just said, we were shy, so we sent you to dancing school. However, they must have done their research because they picked the best teacher in Cincinnati at that point. He was an old vaudevillian, Pep Golden was his
Pep
name.
Pep Golden.
Yes, and he didn't teach technique as much as he taught performance.
Mm.
So consequently, I think that helped me later in my life because I didn't worry so much about the technique of a step, but more or less what they wanted to do with that step. And I learned that from Liza Minnelli, too. She said, after they do the step, then watch their face.
Mm. Oh,
and,
interesting.
And this teacher, I mean, we did Eddie Cantor imitations and Pal Joey and Al Jolson and stuff like that. And then he'd send us out. And we were a bunch of just little kids.
Yeah.
He'd send us out on weekends to do shows in the at the workhouse or the zoo, any place that we could get $5,
right.
You know.
And your parents were supportive of this?
Very supportive because I don't know why. My father kind of always wanted to be in show business. He wanted to lead a band. But we would go out on weekends and so me and my little partner Patsy Heffron, we sort of grew up in the back of saloons, and we thought that was the norm. We didn't I didn't realize other people didn't do show business either, you know, and it wasn't made fun of in school or anything. But
so
I never.
That was your extracurricular activity.
Yeah.
When you were growing up, basically, is you were already doing show business.
Yeah. And then at a certain age, I discovered all the stuff on television, like we said, Ed Sullivan and stuff like that. And I started learning more about the business and more about what variety is and everything.
Let alone a musical, which you had an iconic experience.
Well,
right?
Every other day, every other Sunday, there was a number with Peter Gennaro or Gwen or Fosse, you know, and it seemed like Fosse and Gwen and Peter and Carol Haney and all that, they switched numbers all the time. It wasn't the same number, but I grew up knowing their work.
So you were familiar even in the early
50s
of what they were doing.
In fact, I wanted to study with Peter Gennaro. Uh-huh. Fosse was my idol. Gwen Verdon was my biggest crush in the world.
Wow.
And I would know it from television.
That's incredible. And then I read somewhere that you saw Song of Norway, and that had an impact on your life.
My God, you did good work. yes, it did, because it opened the classical door for me.
Yeah, I mean, of all shows, Song of Norway, I didn't see that one coming. But
yeah, well, it was an old road company or something, but it had all that Grieg music, and I became fond of it, and it started my love of classical music, I think.
And so you graduate high school, and then you just go to New York.
Well, that was the plan. With my folks, you know.
You weren't gonna.
I think maybe they said you can have $1,000. You can go to college. You can go to New York. And my dancing teacher Rita, who was wonderful, but she had a group of. People like me that were on the verge of making it sort of, we had a dance team, and she said, I want to send you kids to New York, to Las Vegas.
Oh.
And my parents said, we didn't pay for all those classes for you to go to Las Vegas. You are going to New York, buddy, whether you like it or not, you know.
Good parents.
Because what they did was in the 10th grade, they came to New York with me, and I studied from Ernest Carlos and people like that here. 11th grade, they let me come by myself. So when I got to the 12th grade, I sort of knew New York. And I knew Kenny Ermston, who was a dancer from Cincinnati.
So
and
you were already sort of figuring out how New York, because that's a big kind of culture shock for Cincinnati.
Oh, it was a culture shock. Do you remember I remember crying on the way to the bus with my little suitcase. I felt like Lily.
Yeah. Do you remember the first Broadway show you saw?
No, but it was around Can-Can time, maybe a little earlier. I saw Wish You Were Here. I saw Can-Can.
With the swimming pool on stage. Wish You Were Here.
Yeah.
Jack Cassidy. Oh, my favorite.
Can-Can was really Can-Can. My favorite.
Well, because,
Gwen.
Yeah. So that was the first time you saw her on stage live.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
So what was that experience like watching her? Now, you didn't know her at that point, but what was it like seeing this woman dance?
Well, I had seen her dance on television,
on television.
I knew that she was spectacular.
Yeah.
And then maybe I read something in Dance Magazine or something like that, but to watch her was unbelievable because she was the greatest dancer I'd seen ever.
What do you think?
Probably still is.
Yeah, agreed. I do not disagree with you. What do you think the greatest lesson you learned from Gwen Verdon?
Oh, my God. There were so many, I don't know. Right off the top of my head, she had the ability to sell out front, but be able to watch behind her because she'd give us notes.
That is such a good
I know. She would give us notes, and we'd say, how did you see
that?
Yeah. You're out front performing.
Right.
You know, but so maybe it's don't ever let down in front of Gwen Verdon.
Yeah.
But she didn't.
That just shows the awareness she had while she was performing.
Yes.
That she could deliver, could give you that energy to the young Harveys in the audience, and yet she's such a team player and knows exactly what's going on around her. I mean, that's...
Well, I think she also had the best teacher in the world with Jack Cole. I mean, whatever.
We try to bring his name up as much as possible on this podcast.
Well, he was our leader.
He was created, you know, jazz.
Yeah, he did.
The way we think of it today.
You know, I keep saying there would be no Fosse or no Gower, no, nothing without Jack Cole.
Yeah.
Just don't let down. She never let down, don't think. And she would go on in whatever condition she was in. I remember she went through hell on New Girl in Town. George Abbott gave her hell. Oh. And she was having trouble with the role, and she was he was at her, and you know, she was going to Sandy Meisner to learn to act.
Oh.
And he was as method as you could get,
right?
So she came and brought all that to the theater. Now that is so unlike George Abbott.
Oh yeah,
He would say, "Gwen, just say the line, Gwen." She'd be up there spending 5 minutes on some teary scene.
Right, right. Feeling this musical.
Say the line, Gwen.
That's a great memory. I have to ask you, what's it like being directed by George Abbott?
Well, I didn't care for him.
Yeah.
First of all, when you're a dancer, no matter who you are, you're almost always on the side of the choreographer. Mm. And Fosse and George Abbott and Hal Prince didn't care for his choreography during that period.
Huh.
So they gave Fosse and Gwen a really rough time. And there was something called the Red Light Ballet that was really dirty. It was a dirty ballet.
Tell us about this, for those of us who are unfamiliar with the Red Light Ballet.
Well, it was way, way before Cabaret, or before we saw girls laying on chairs with their legs in the air. And, you know,
this is 1957-ish, I want to say.
57-ish, yeah. I think, yeah. You know, it was way ahead of its time, and Gwen and Fosse loved it. So did we all loved it because it was new. It was new. It was startling. But Hal Prince made it. He made us cut it in Philly, and then we, little by little, it got back. It got put back in. But it was wonderful.
Yeah. This was your first Fosse show?
Yeah,
on Broadway.
It was my second. Third.
Okay.
I had done what started me with Fosse was the National Company of Damn Yankees.
Which, am I right in saying that was your first big job?
Yeah,
and
that was my first big job.
So just to be clear, you had stars in your eyes. You wanted to work with Gwen Verdon and Bob Fosse. You went to New York City when you were 18 and you got your first job and you were working with Bob Fosse.
Yes.
Okay. Just had to say that out loud. That's,
yes. And then, and then I was lucky because I wound up in L.A. I left the company of Damn Yankees in L.A. and he was auditioning for Pajama Game, the movie of Pajama Game.
Right.
So I got that. And then during that time, he said to me, would you consider coming back to New York and being in New Girl in Town? And I jumped 40 feet high, you know, and didn't let them know how excited I was. But I said, of course I would. He said, you will have to audition, but you'll get it. So
that's a nice audition.
I know it is.
Those are the best ones.
Oh, please. If that would happen now, God.
Yeah. Audition, but you'll get it.
So your first time meeting Bob Fosse, starstruck?
Oh, completely. Oh, we all had crushes on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody did.
Oh.
And where did you audition for that Damn Yankees? Was that at a theater? Do you remember if it was? I mean, was he at the first audition when you were auditioning?
Yeah, it was at the 46th Street Theater, which was where Damn Yankees was playing.
Which is where the Richard Rogers Theater is.
Uh-huh.
The Hamilton is.
And we auditioned and got it.
So let's talk about when you were auditioning. Nowadays, you have to go into a room, and there's a tiny little room like the one we're in now, and there's 40 auditions and a million sides. What was auditioning like when you were first starting out?
Well, first of all, there weren't so many people,
yeah,
which eliminates that long wait that you have to go sign up at 5 in the morning,
right,
and all that. I don't know. I haven't auditioned in years, so I don't really know. But also, you auditioned on a stage, which is a lot easier.
I think so.
It's not in a room. It's on a stage, and you can bring your bigness or whatever it is to that stage, and they can see you on a stage. It very seldom happens anymore, but it was easier to audition then. And they you might have been one of 5 instead of one of 30 or one of 50.
And dance calls, were they held on the stage like know, like we see in a Chorus Line, you know, like the movie or something like that, or on stage?
Yeah, but there weren't 30,000
exactly
of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. And then was Fosse running the audition, or was he just sitting in the back?
No, he would run the audition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, George Abbott would. We wouldn't have listened to George Abbott. We just didn't care for George Abbott. Yeah. And he gave line readings.
Right,
and
he was known for that,
and
right?
Yeah, and suddenly you're studying acting, and the director's telling you to do a line reading, and you go, well, wait a minute, that's not what I've been learning.
Right, I've got to find my truth.
Yeah, in my school here, you know.
But it's George Abbott, so, I mean, even then, he's I feel like he was perpetually old, but he was...
Well, he wasn't mean, he was just sort of not there. And on the movie Pajama Game, I don't know what he did. He got paid for... he was just around all the time. New Girl in Town, at least he was there. He didn't quite know what to do with that project because it was Anna Christie to music, you know.
Yeah.
Was strange, but
what was your go-to audition song?
I don't remember. It was so long ago, but the one I used to do for like Follies and stuff, After Today from Dr. Doolittle.
Oh,
wow.
I don't know why I chose that. And then I would do Tonight at 8 as a medley with Tonight at 8. I would mix it up with 9 o'clock from but I would use 8 o'clock. So I'd sing most of the song about 8 o'clock, and then when it got to at 9 o'clock, she said 9 o'clock, I would change it to 8.
What a genius.
That's thinking. That's
I don't know. I don't know.
I like that.
But I think my favorite audition that worked was for Annie Warbucks.
The sequel. Yes.
Yeah. Marty said, sing something funny. And it was for the butler. It was a little, little tiny role. Sing something funny. So I thought, what's funny? What's funny? What's funny? I know. I'll sing I Don't Remember Christmas, but I'll sing it to Hugh instead of you. I'll sing it to Hugh, my butler friend that I'm firing. So every time I got to Hugh, Marty would start laughing, and then I'd start laughing.
That's funny.
I don't remember Christmas, and I don't remember Hugh.
See, that is thinking outside the box for a comedy song. That's very smart.
And did you meet Martin Charnin when you were doing West Side Story?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
He was still there.
So what was it like going into West Side Story?
Oh, scarier than hell.
Yeah. How come?
Oh, my God. I had 2 weeks, and I think I was the first total. There had been swings that had gotten the job, but I think I was the total first replacement.
Mm.
They gave me a little ceremony before I went in, it was very scary.
Well, because show was set, and you're replacing. So this team has already been going on. They've already gone through their crazy rehearsals that we've heard a lot about because we've interviewed a lot of them. And then you have to, replacing is not the easiest job. I mean, it really isn't.
Oh, it's a terrible job.
Because you kind of have to fit into, even though you know the moves, you kind of like have to fit
into
that world.
Well, you have to please everyone, know, and you know. So West Side, especially there's Jerry Robbins, you want to please more than anybody.
Right.
So that was rough, that my transition into West Side Story.
Until I
calmed down, and then it was just
right, and
great.
Then you become a part of the group and all of that. Yeah.
What was it like working with Jerry Robbins? What did you admire about him so much?
The fact that he, which is also what you don't admire about him, but the fact that he was never satisfied with his own work.
Mm.
And that made him difficult with other people because he would expect it sometimes to see it, and it wasn't very good what he saw. And he never settled, and so you never settled. So the reason people get, you know, he did scream at people was because I think he felt that they were letting him down.
Mm.
That happened, I think, with... Well, Russ Tamblyn was a movie star already, so let's face that.
Yes.
And Michael Kidd camouflaged him in Seven Brides so brilliantly that everybody thought he was a dancer, and he wasn't. Right. He was a gymnast, and so he had trouble with Jerry Robbins' choreography. He also didn't want to come to ballet class at 8 in the morning, you know.
Because Jerry would run class.
Oh, yeah, Jerry taught class most of the time. I was lucky because both Bob Fosse and Jerry Robbins mentored me.
Right. Essentially your mentors, but also dance teachers, really.
Well,
I mean,
and Jerry took me aside many times and explained what a step meant and all that. And even then, I knew how lucky I was to have that happen.
Yeah.
It wouldn't happen now.
Right. Not like that.
What would you say are the major differences between Mr. Fosse and Mr. Robbins?
Well, Mr. Robbins, I better watch out here. Mr. Fosse had a limited amount of steps, and he knew that. And he always said, I have a limited amount of steps, which meant he also had a limited amount of choreography. Jerry just took whatever the property was and said, okay, now we're going to do it this way. And so that's why Fiddler is different than Dances at a Gathering, or all his stuff is different, because he didn't have a style. He put the style of the show or the ballet into his style.
Wow.
And Fosse didn't.
Well put. Very well put. How are they similar?
They're all based on Jack Hole.
There it is. Yeah.
Back to Jack Hole again.
Yeah.
Back to Jack Hole.
Yeah.
Asymmetric, think, yeah.
Especially Fosse, Bobby. Yeah. And that was Gwen, too, her influence.
Right, because she danced with Jack, right? I mean, didn't
oh,
she?
Oh, yeah. She was Jack's assistant.
That's right. Yeah.
So let's go back to West Side Story, if we made the film version of West Side Story. How did that come into your
I don't know. I don't know. We all auditioned. Everybody that did the show, I think, got an audition for the movie. And I got a call back to come in and do Riff. I came in and did Riff. And then I got another call back, just a general audition. And I had gone into Gypsy at that point, and everybody said, you know, you left West Side Story. That's a blow to you. Then now you're going to leave Gypsy to do the movie of West Side? And they said, you're never going to work for Jerry. But I said, but I'm going to work for Jerry three. This is the third time. So what's your point
here? What's the problem here?
Yeah. And he took me out of Gypsy and did the movie.
Gypsy was with Ethel Merman. Was she still in it?
Yeah.
Mm, yeah, that must have been wild to share the stage with.
Well, I got. I don't think I'm ever supposed to talk about this because there was maybe going to be a lawsuit or something. But Gypsy, Paul Wallace and I got real close to each getting it. He got it, but they were ready to fire him out of town. Mm. When Arthur Lawrence gets a hate on for somebody, watch out.
Yeah, we've heard that.
And he didn't care for Paul so much. And I thought I was going to maybe they were going to replace Paul before it came in. They didn't. First of all, the number started working for Gypsy. It wound up being Gypsy's number instead of Tulsa's number because you watched her and she was so pathetically little girlish and all that. And then also Paul started dating Ethel Merman's daughter.
Oh.
So anyhow, but I got to, then what happened was when I got West Side Story, Ruthie Mitchell said, you're going to, we're going to put you on because Paul is really losing his voice and we don't want to have no cover here when you leave. So we're going to let you do 3 weeks.
Oh my.
So I got to do Tulsa for 3 weeks with Merman.
Oh my gosh.
So what is it like sharing a stage with her?
Well, I was in love with her. I thought she was fantastic. And, you know, people would say, oh, she's marking the show. And I thought, she's not marking the show. I watched her cry every night. I just loved her. She was, I got to, because I did West Side, and Ruthie Mitchell and Lo Hardin were the stage managers of that. I got to go into their room every night. That was my first stop when I came through the stage door to go into the stage manager's room. And Ethel would come in and tell us the news of the day. And what really, two or three things. I've said this before. I hope I am repeating. But first of all, she found out, she came in and she went, oh, I just heard Tab Hunter's gay. Well, that made us all laugh a lot. And then Billie Holiday died, and she went to Billie Holiday's funeral. Oh. And then she went to see Lena Horne at the Waldorf, and she said, you know, we forget how beautiful she is and how well she sings, but she's singing great.
So that's special.
Yeah.
She could admire another broad.
Now, to go back for a second, did you leave West Side Story on stage to go do Redhead?
Mm-hmm.
Redhead is one of my favorite musicals.
I love how much you love it.
And it doesn't get done anymore. Mm-mm. It just doesn't get done anymore. So can you share some experiences about what it was like working on Redhead?
There's no Gwen Verdon anymore.
There it is.
That's totally it, I think. There are capable dancers. There are capable singers. They are capable personalities, but they're not all, nobody allows them to be all three. And one of my friends said, the trick to working in show business now is be mediocre. Because if you're too good, you're going to scare the people, and they're not going to hire you. And if you're not that good, you won't get the job. So I think it's because there's no Gwen. It wasn't the greatest show in the world either.
So you did the movie of West Side Story.
Yes.
It's a huge hit.
Yes.
An incredibly huge hit.
Yeah.
What is that like, seeing your face 50 feet high on the screen?
Well, we didn't know. First of all, they kept telling us, we don't know if this movie's going to work or not. Uh-oh. Now, we think it might be an art house movie. So don't go around telling your friends you're in the best movie ever, because we just don't know.
Who was this? The studio or Jerry?
Yeah, the
Robbins?
Studio. Everyone there. Maybe not Jerry.
It's an art house film.
It's an art
yeah.
film.
Yeah, and so when we finally saw a preview at Grauman's, it was 80 feet tall. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were 80 feet tall on the screen. And was a shock because we
and who were you in it? What was your name in the
mouthpiece?
Okay.
It's a
smaller, I remember it.
Smaller jet part.
Curious. Yeah. Well, your guitar and on stage. I was curious.
You also did the movie of Mary Poppins.
Yeah,
you were a chimney sweep.
You were a chimney sweep. What was it like working for the Disney Corporation?
Well, I was working for the at that point the Disney was not cheap like it is now.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to worry about anything. And as a job, it was lovely. Now, that was mainly because it was Mark Brough and Dee Dee Wood, who were two of the loveliest people you've ever known. Mm. And also, Disney, I had just come from MGM, from Silk Stockings or something, where MGM was a little prison-like. Disney was flowers and landscape, and they only charged you what the meal cost them and the commissary. And I know he was a Bircher, and I know he didn't like blacks or Jews or gays or whatever, but it was a joy to work for him. And he would come back on his little golf court and bring a golf cart and bring like Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons and Charles Laughton and people like that back. Because we did, we took the job not knowing it was other than another movie job.
It was a gig.
Yeah, it was a gig.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when Dee Dee approached me, I said, Dee Dee, I'm acting. I'm doing something at CBS and I'd rather just keep acting. And she said, well, okay, but Burt Michaels and she named a whole list of my favorite dancers on the West Coast. And I thought, okay, you got me.
Here we go.
You know, you know.
Why did you not move to the West Coast?
Yeah.
I thought it was it would be a dumb move, but I don't know why I thought that. I loved it out there, and
you seem to be going back and forth
worked.
A lot.
It's, no, I stayed out there. I did a lot of dancing on television and stuff like that. But I don't know why I never thought of moving back. And the reason I did move back was because Herb Ross offered Tucker and I Anyone Can Whistle.
Aha! Uh-huh.
So let's
good
talk
transition.
About this. Yes.
Well done. Thank you, Harvey.
Oh, God. I'm talking so much.
No, it's delicious. So, Anyone Can Whistle.
9 performances?
I think so, yeah.
Well, Tucker and I never assumed it would be anything but a major hit.
Right.
After Gypsy and all the and West Side and all the other stuff. So when he said, you want to do that, we went, oh, my God, yes. And we lived in Gene Gavin's dumpy apartment and started rehearsals and fell in love with the property.
Did you know?
Everybody that, there was only one person, and he was a soap opera guy, who didn't seem to me that they would have laid under a subway for that show.
Really?
Yeah, we all wished it the best, and even though there were moments with Angela where they were going to get rid of her and
right.
all that, and
she wanted another song.
And yeah, and then people died. Everybody started dying in it, and
like in the show.
Yeah.
Oh,
Henry Lasko.
No. Henry Lasko died, and then Tucker fell in the pit one night.
What?
And then because he fell in the pit, a musician had a heart attack and died the next day.
I never knew any of this.
Yeah.
Oh, Anyone Can Whistle was fraught with, is that the word?
Sure.
With problems. Oh. I mean, I think, I always say we never drank as much as we did at the Variety Club at any show I've ever been in. If Anyone Can Whistle, because we wanted it to succeed so badly, right. and we sort of knew it wouldn't.
What was it about it that was so special that made you want it to succeed?
Special. It was ahead of its time, and it said things that hadn't been said before.
Yeah,
and although in reality it was ahead of its time, but 3 months later, it was behind its time. It's funny. Yeah. It's funny how I don't quite understand. And then it was confusing for the audience. It was mean, sort of.
Mm.
You know, it had its problems with Angela. She wanted to play it a certain way, and they wanted her to be a cream puff. And she had just come off Manchurian Candidate and the other one, All Fall Down. And she wanted to be nice in it, and they didn't want that. They wanted the comedy, mean comedy. And she finally went back to it accidentally. How it happened, it seemed, my recollection is that... Henry Lasko did have a heart attack, and he couldn't perform, so the understudy was put on, and that afternoon, we walked in, and Arthur said, the understudy is going to go on tonight. We're going to rehearse the understudy. Well, Angela said her first line. Well, where's your line? He didn't know one line,
oh,
I don't
goodness.
Think. And so... After about five lines, Angela started laughing. Then Arthur started laughing, and the two of them sort of broke the ice that way.
Really?
Yeah. Now, that's another Rashomon story where you think, well, did that really happen? But I know that they were going to fire Angela. I mean, I was privy to some of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Do they do that thing where there's another actress coming in to watch the show?
Oh, though? Nancy Walker was, yeah.
Oh, there
they,
it is.
They
oh.
had Nancy Walker in the third row. Very visible for all of us.
Wow.
I know.
That's so wild they
it's
used
so
to do
mean.
That. They,
it's so
they,
mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when you were out of town, I think you were out of town in Philly with that, Arthur Lawrence kept telling you, "It's Philly audiences aren't going to get it, but New York audiences will. Don't worry."
That's exactly what he'd say. He said, you know, we'll take New York, but we won't take Philly. And then people used to... once Harry Gardino was taking his bow, and some man in the first row stood up and gave him the finger.
Oh my gosh!
Huh. Well, wait, what's? Oh no! What? He didn't give him the finger. He gave him a thumbs down.
Oh.
So on Harry's bow, he gave him the finger.
It's a very combative theater.
That's incredible.
So much see, that first act was combative because the theater rows came on and we were the audience and we laughed at the real audience.
Yeah.
Now that's hard to do.
Yeah.
Hard to take for an audience.
Yes.
Yeah, really hard imagery.
That's bold.
Very bold.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's the original new musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And then you were in the original production of Hello, Dolly.
No, I was in the Road Company.
Oh, sorry, in the Road Company.
Yeah.
But eventually you made your way to New York. Is that correct with it or no?
Yeah, no.
You were on the road with Carol.
I spent a year with Carol.
Right.
And then Eve Arden came in, and that was wonderful. And then maybe a year later, they needed a Barnaby, and they called and said, would you do it? And fortunately, my friend Will McKenzie, who lives on the West Coast now, we're the best of friends, and we were the Cornelius and Barnaby.
Oh,
and we couldn't, as far as I'm concerned, there couldn't have been a better association.
Like dynamic, yeah.
Now, I have to ask about this, because I think this is so fascinating. You were doing so many musicals, and then Our Town comes into your orbit. And very quickly, if you don't mind, I'd like to review some of the people that were in the cast with you. Ed Begley, John Fiedler, Henry Fonda, Margaret Hamilton, Mildred Natwick, John Randolph. This was a company. This was a real...
And you were George.
And I was
George.
Scared to death.
I would have been... I would have been too.
How does this happen?
I did a screen test for Dalton Trumbo for Johnny Got His Gun. I don't know if you know the play... The book or the movie. Do you know Dalton Trumbo?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he was an idol because he was blacklisted and all that. And for some reason, Donald Driver got a hold of my screen test and called me and said, you're not going to believe this, but you don't have to audition. I've seen your screen test, and I want you to play George. And, of course, I was thrilled. And then I was petrified. I mean, that first day, I just wanted to get everybody's autograph. And, you know. I learned a lot from Fonda.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he
was the stage manager in that, yeah.
Yeah, he cut me down. Well, no, I wouldn't say half, but he took away a lot of my extra stuff that I didn't need to do. Now, if you watch his movies, you will see his work. If you zero in on just his work, he's so minimal and he's so believable that he got me to do sort of a Fonda performance with it.
What a great mentor.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was a lovely production, and we were sorry it never happened. It was when everybody was naked on Broadway, you know, Noel Coward with the naked people,
right.
And this and that, the critic for the Times came out and said, "I don't like this play." So we fought an uphill thing. Otherwise, we would have been the sensation of Broadway that season.
Right.
And it's a shame because somebody came along afterwards and Robbie Benson was in it and Hal Holbrook, I guess, I don't know. And it got televised and it was not nearly as good as ours.
Just timing. I mean, it was a different time.
And we went to the West Coast to... We were booked a certain amount of time, and during that time, the audience caught on to it. But it was the same with West Side, too. They booked it somewhere else, and then it suddenly picked up business, and we had to go to That's why I didn't go to the West Coast with West Side.
Oh.
But this I did, and it's a shame because had we stayed on Broadway, we could have run a lot longer.
Was yours televised? Was your hour television?
No,
filmed
it wasn't.
Or anything? Nothing.
Nothing.
So it just disappeared.
Nothing. Just disappeared.
Besides Henry Fonda, what was it like working with, let's say, Mildred Natwick or John Randolph?
Okay. So there's a scene in our town, surreal scene where we're both at the wedding, but we're really not at the wedding, and it's very confusing, and it's very hard to work out. And so one night on Broadway, we're doing this scene, and she goes, "You're upstaging me." You know, what could be worse? So I, at intermission, I go to her room, and I say, "Millie, I'm so sorry. What happened was a light was blocking I was standing in front of it, and it was blocking her light to get on her face.
Yeah.
So I moved upstage.
So she could be seen. Yeah.
So she could be seen, but that means that I'm upstaging her. And anyhow, I said, "I'm so sorry." And she went, "Oh, honey, I was kidding." And then she said, "I never knew what that scene meant anyhow." And I said, "Neither did I."
Oh, my gosh.
Brilliant. When you had worked with Hal Prince previously, it was as a producer. He's your producer. And now he's going to be your director in Follies. Director and producer, I should say, in Follies. So how does Follies come around for you?
I got a call to audition, and I came. I was in California, and I came back, and I auditioned, and they said, "It's yours."
So what were rehearsals like? This is such a seminal piece of...
Well, rehearsals were...
With Michael Bennett now.
Rehearsals were so scattered and so episodic that you didn't know what the book was even.
Oh.
And you just did it. You just did what you were told and then hoping it would all fit together. Mm-hmm.
And when did that moment... Was there a seminal moment where you thought, "Oh, my gosh,
no,
we got this"?
No, there wasn't, actually. Huh. It was little by little by little.
Yeah.
You know, and then we heard Yvonne saying, "I'm still here," and Fifi couldn't remember her lines ever. And there's a funny thing. Ethel Chate and Fifi were always competitive. And one time... We were called into rehearsal, and there was no seat for Fifi.
Wow.
And so Ethel looked around, and she went, "Squattez-vous, Fifi."
Squattez-vous.
Gotta love that.
Yeah.
Gene Nelson, you were supposed to be a young Gene Nelson, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about working with Gene Nelson.
Well, we were told to... absorb as much of as the older people as we could, so we could be a little bit like them.
Yeah.
You know, and I had Gene Nelson, was one of my favorite movie star dancers, on an equal with Fred with Gene Kelly.
Oh my!
And so it was a dream at first, and then when I found out he was just a normal guy, it was even better. And I wouldn't say we bonded, but we were pretty close, pretty tight.
What was audience reaction like?
Oh, they hated it.
Oh, so,
oh my God, they left in all through the run. They left in rows.
How do you keep your enthusiasm up when you're seeing people walking out?
Because you know that it's a project that enough good people had told us that this is exceptional. And we knew that the material was. The trouble was it was so episodic that you didn't feel like you were really part of it.
Mm.
You were a little bit of a part of it, but all we did were our numbers, and that was just about it.
You come know? On, you do your thing, and then out you go.
And most of the people were like that, too, the older people. They'd come on and do their number and go.
Mm.
So we knew we had something special, but we didn't know where it would take us or what happened or whether we'd run or not.
Are you surprised by how beloved the show is now?
Yes, of course.
Do you go and see subsequent productions of it? I know you've directed them, right?
I directed some, and I played Buddy in some.
Yes.
And because I've done that, I don't care to see it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've had it.
Yeah.
It's like I'm folly stout. I know line. I mean, it's like now I know line readings. But that's one of the troubles with being older is that I don't want to see anyone else do Gypsy because Ethel Merman's line readings are in my head.
Right.
And none of them are as good as hers to me. And the same with Follies. No one will ever top Dorothy Collins. So I don't go see the Follies much.
Who did Lacage on the Road for quite some time?
I think about a year, yeah.
And who was your George opposite you?
Larry.
Larry Kurt.
Larry.
Oh. Little West Side Reunion.
Oh, I forgot to explain all that. Yeah, that was wonderful because... Larry, since West Side Story, has been the leader of our little group, which consisted of Marty Charnin and Jeannie Charnin and Alan Johnson and a whole lot of good people. Since then, we've all fallen apart or gotten Alzheimer's or whatever. But Larry was our leader, and we listened to him, and he was extremely funny to us. Now, to other people, he was a little brazen and a little bit snotty, but we understood him so well. So when this job came along, and I knew he was sick with AIDS, I thought, this is perfect. I get to be with Larry for a year. You know, it doesn't scare me. I don't care what's, you know, I just get to be with Larry. And he was still strong and able to do a brilliant job. As we went on, he got a little bit weaker and a little bit. But that was how Larry Kirk. In fact, Leroy and I always share parts. You know, he does it there, I'll do it here.
Applause. And
we were at Fritz and Barry's for a party, and Leroy said, well, you know, Fritz, I can't really do that last company because I have to do Lorelei or something, and I can't do it. And jokingly, I said, well, then I'll do it. I do everything you do anyhow. And Fritz went, oh, okay. And 2 weeks later, I get this phone call saying, we've set an audition up for you for Arthur. And I said, no. I was kidding. I was kidding, please. And it was too late to get out of it. When I went in, they spent 3 hours making you up and putting you in a dress and all that. And it had nothing, absolutely nothing about being gay or anything. It was only that there was another human being in that mirror besides me.
That's right.
And I thought, well, this is what people work for all their lives.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I took it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. How did audiences across the country react to the show?
Well, we thought... We played Shreveport, Louisiana, and I thought, Larry, I said to him, I am not getting near you tonight. When you sing Saw in the Sand, I'll be 4 feet away. And didn't you know they stood up just like every other audience?
Yeah.
It's built in. I mean, Arthur or Jerry or whoever does built in the Hello Dollies and the Lacage. It's just built in where you walk down and the audience...
Yeah,
they go crazy.
Very true.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to jump back for a second, if I may, and that is on Follies. You worked with Michael Bennett. So, what was it like working with Michael Bennett?
Well, we knew he was going to be a genius.
You knew.
Yeah. And we stayed clear of we, meaning maybe Kurt Peterson and I, and Marty Rolfe, Virginia was out there doing her own thing.
No, it's okay.
It's fine.
But we, because Arthur, because Hal and Michael were at each other every minute on that show.
Yeah.
About how they each wanted to make it work and how each had a different approach. Michael wanted more jokes and he wanted a crystal ball and Hal just wanted more words and anyhow, we stayed away from any conflict we had to get into or did get into. Mm-hmm. We didn't get into it because we stayed away from it. So I never really got to say, be in Michael's camp or be in Hal's camp. I tried to be in both camps. And,
right. Yeah. Switzerland.
Switzerland, yeah.
Yeah.
And that same happened to me when I came into Gypsy. Sondra Church and Merman were having a feud, and Sondra grabbed me, and I became part of Sondra Church's little group.
It's interesting how the territory...
The dynamics.
The dynamics of that all works. Indeed. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I'm just going to say the word sextet. What was sextet with Dixie Carter?
It was fabulous.
Yeah?
As a piece of theater, it probably stunk. But five out of six of us, not including Mary Small, bonded like crazy. Dixie was fantastic. She and Jerry Lanning had an affair during it. We got the director fired, Jared Barkley.
Yeah.
Because
he wasn't coming around. Oh. He thought he could choreograph it, and he just wasn't coming around. But otherwise, because Jerry Lanning was like our leader.
Yeah.
We had great fun.
What was it? Was it a book musical?
It was a book musical about three couples, a gay couple, me and Bobby Spencer, and Dixie and Jerry, and the Mary Small and her boyfriend, whatever.
John Newton.
Was it?
Yeah. According to this, it's John Newton. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Not a hit.
He was good. Oh, not a hit at all. No. But we had one of the old time stage managers, May Muth, I think her name was.
Yeah.
Wow.
And she was like Mammy Yogum. We used to love her like you couldn't believe. I wish we would have run longer because Dixie was married to sort of a gangster, semi-gangster, and we thought, well, we're all going to die.
Right, she's having an affair.
She's having an affair with Jerry Lanning, and he's married, and we're all going to be murdered.
Instead, you just had the critics instead.
Yeah, the critics did it instead. So let's talk then about Barnum. Yeah. So you're offered a standby to Jim Dale, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And you were eager to... you were okay being a standby.
I had to talk myself into it. Mm. My dad had just died, and I knew that an awful amount of work had gone into it. And I was aware that the first couple of days I could tell that most of the people were circus people in it, and how do I put it? They didn't really know much about me, and they didn't know I had done some Broadway stuff.
You've been around,
and Glenn didn't help that situation at all.
Glenn Close,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, when I did Sunset with her, it was the total opposite. We fell in love with each other.
Okay,
but on Barnum, it was rough because she didn't want me. She wanted Jim to do every performance, and she'd get jealous if, like, one time I brought Liza Minnelli backstage. I'm talking about Glenn. I shouldn't.
No, you're all right. You haven't said anything.
I like her, but so yeah. Can you?
How did you know Liza, by the way? How did you guys become friends?
I did six Judy Garland shows.
What?
Well, I danced on 6 Judy Garland shows.
How did we not talk about that yet? That's...
Wow.
Okay, 6 Judy Garland shows.
And, but I met Liza in New York, actually, when she was doing Best Foot Forward. But we, I think she and I did a couple Garlands together. The Christmas show, mainly.
And you guys clearly hit it off.
I was there. We sat together for the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I did 6 of them. I did a couple of those Bing Crosby specials.
I think it's pretty awesome that you started out, you were doing New Girl in Town, this early Fosse shows, and then fast forward past the 80s, you're doing Scarlet Pimpernel, Sunset Boulevard, like this sort of like new version of musical theater. I think it's kind of awesome and amazing that your career flowed with the times as the evolution of the
golden age to conceptual
musicals. You like literally traveled through time with musical theater.
I think that was dictated because that was all that was around.
Sure, sure.
It's funny though. I can't remember one thing from Scarlet Pimpernel, but I can do all of West Side Story for you.
I love.
I can't. It would, Doug Sills started singing over the bridge, and I thought, what is he singing?
Yep, that's what I thought when I saw it, too. Sorry.
Then I saw Sunset again with Glenn, and I thought, I swung that show. I did every single one of these lyrics.
Right, you watched
it. I don't
remember
any of them.
That's a different piece
Shelby,
now.
Shelby, what you doing?
It's okay. I prefer the golden age too, my friend.
Yeah. But also, in terms of movie musicals, you were also in Enchanted. Is that correct?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Silk Stockings.
Yeah.
And The Girl Most Likely for Gower.
Yeah. You worked with Gower Champion. We didn't even get a chance to discuss that yet. So what was it like working for Gower Champion?
Well, I love Gower. He gave me a private audition for that movie, for The Girl Most Likely.
Oh.
What happened was that Tucker Smith and I, who I talked about, we both got in Damn Yankees at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And we probably were bad, but I think we used to try and outsell each other.
Yeah, sure.
And
You were young.
And anyhow, it was a very good night for me, I remember. And Gower was in the audience. This is in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true, my... I just worshipped Martin Gower, and I said to him how much I loved him, and he said, well, I enjoyed you too very much.
Mm.
And I said, thank you. Then I read in the Variety out there that he was casting this musical, and I wrote him and said, I met you backstage. Is there any chance I could audition for you? And he wrote me back and said, yeah, come in. And I had a private audition. And then got to be in this. That was my first big movie thing. Jane Powell.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not bad.
This has been so wonderful, and I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming in and sharing your memories with us. And
did we do okay?
Oh,
we did great.
Yeah.
Oh,
you know, we did really good.
I'm going to ask you one last question, if I can. What advice would you give to yourself that's just getting off the bus from Ohio and coming into New York City back in the 1950s? What do you know now that you wish you had known then?
I think I knew more then. I don't know. I always thought this, so it's not a new thought. But you really have to love the business more than you love yourself in the business.
Mm.
Because it doesn't ever work out the way you want it to. And that's how you can deal with the disappointments. Just keep working. I've said that before. My name's been above the title. It's been below the title. But the point is, usually I've kept working. And you can find as much value in the ensemble as you can in a lead.
Good day, Mr. Thomas.
Good day, Mr. Schneider.
Well, it has happened. We finally hit over 100 iTunes reviews, and we'd like to thank each and every person who took the time to do so.
Huzzah! Now, huzzah. We want to climb those charts even faster, and that is where you lovely folks who have not yet rated us come in.
The process is very simple. On your podcast app, tap the search tab, enter our name, Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, tap the search key, tap our beautiful logo, tap the reviews, tap write a review, then tap your way into our hearts.
Tap your troubles away. That's nice, Rob. Once you are there, you can rate us from 1 star to 5 stars. Think of 1 star as Hervé V... Rob, how do you say this name?
Hervé Villechel.
Oh, dear God, I walked right into that one. Think of 1 star as Hervé Villechel and Ema Sumac in Sideshow, and 5 stars as front row seats to the opening night of Gypsy.
Buddy, kiss me. Yeah, they kissed me for the first time.
I thought that was pretty good.
We want to get good reviews, Rob. We want to get good reviews.
Excuse me, Arthur Lawrence. Excuse me for trying to liven up our commercial ads a little bit.
8-minute long commercial.
It's an infomercial at this point. I'm going to be like that lady that sells you the copper pots.
Look at this. You can put 400 pounds of manure in it, and it slides right out. Then you can make an omelet.
You got another line, Kevin? I'm
waiting for you to say, plus you can leave your comment and let us know if you're liking what guests are liking.
Plus you can leave a comment to let us know what you are liking, what you're not liking at this point, or what guests you'd like to hear next.
So head on over to iTunes and let us know what you think of our little show.
Speaking of little, I'll tell you a story about Charles Lawton later.
Thanks, guys.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard. So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.